Hello, and welcome to Countercurrents Radio. Today we are presenting a talk given by Mark Weber at a Countercurrents gathering during the summer of 2011. The topic of Mark's talk is the Jewish question today.
The first person to speak today is Mark Weber of the Institute for Historical Review. I've known Mark for some years now, and he is an eloquent man, and I'm not going to give opportunities for you to draw any invidious comparisons between him and me, so I'm just going to give the microphone to him and let him talk.
Yeah, thank you, Gregory, very much for inviting me here. It's a tremendous pleasure to be here. I'm very encouraged, and I might say more about this later, but every time over the years that I've gone to events like this in a larger sense, I'm more and more impressed with the quality, the intelligence, the awareness, the perceptiveness of the people in these meetings. And it's a tremendous difference over the years. Fewer and fewer cranky people and more intelligent people.
No, that's right.
And it's very, very encouraging to see this. So many of the remarks that have been made this morning have been remarks that I thought, that's very good, that's right, and so forth, and very glad these. But one of them, of course, is how our worldview, our outlook is vindicated by reality, by truth. And I don't mean that just in the scientific sense. I think that's an extremely important aspect of that as well, that not only scientific discoveries and so forth validate our worldview, but I'm struck enormously that with each passing month, each passing week, practically each passing day, news events that take place vindicate, validate our essential worldview and make it possible for us to speak more frankly and openly with other people who can see at least dimly some of this, and also has the effect of discrediting the, I think, lunatic worldview of our adversaries that prevails in our country. In 1992, I had lunch with George Will. His secretary had arranged a luncheon. George Will's sister lives in Newport Beach, and our offices are in Orange County in Southern California, and she had arranged this thing. She later apologized because Will actually lied to her and to me about the nature of the meeting. And actually, as it happens, he used the occasion to write a hit piece about me that was syndicated all over the United States and even the world. My mother happened to be in Europe at the time, and she saw this horrible piece about me in the Herald, International Herald Tribune. And it's amazing the extent to which deceit, lies, and so forth still have an impact, even if they're baseless. And George Will, as anybody knows, I think, is a master at deceit, misrepresentation, and so forth. But he does it in a very clever way, so he has an impact that way. But during the course of the luncheon, he was taking notes and so forth and not getting quite as much good quotes, I think, as he wanted. So he cut to the chase with a question that I find does cut to the chase very often in conversations with all sorts of people. The question was, Mr. Weber or Mark, I forget what he said. He said, why does anti-Semitism exist? Well, that's a very good question, and it deserves a good answer, because it comes up constantly in our society. We have a branch now of the U.S. State Department set up to monitor anti-Semitism. There's no other anti-anything the U.S. State Department monitors, but they're searching out for any examples of anti-Semitism. And indeed, the name of the topic that in this session we're supposed to be talking about, the Jewish question, is already a very alarming thing. The Jewish, oh my gosh, what does that mean? In fact, I was in a courtroom once, and they said, Mr. Weber, what do you mean by the Jewish question? As if that's a terrible thing. Well, during the course of the luncheon then with George Will, when he asked this question, I gave an answer that I thought was sort of clever, but also I think accurate. I said, I think anti-Semitism exists for the same reason that Theodor Herzl, the founder of modern Zionism, says it exists, and that he laid out in his book, The Jewish State. He said that anti-Semitism exists as a natural consequence of the fact that Jews live in non-Jewish societies, but that Jews think of themselves and act as a separate people and promote their own group interests, and that these group interests often conflict with those of the people they live among. That's pretty obvious, I think, and in fact, that's, I think, historically accurate. And Theodor Herzl felt that This conflict is inevitable as long as Jews live as a separate group, as a nation, he called them a folk, he wrote it in German, as a nation among other people, and that the solution to this, he believed, in fact he wrote in his diary, he called it the final solution of the Jewish question, was for Jews to become a normal people by living in a country of their own. Well, of course, in our society, you're supposed to think that Zionism is a wonderful thing, except if you're very sincere about it and say, yes, all the Jews should live in another country. But in our society, this is a very big issue. Anyway, I said this to George Will, and I said, I think Theodor Herzl was accurate in explaining this, and it's a phenomenon that's come up time and time again over the centuries in many different cultures, many different societies. And that was my answer. And then he was taking notes and so forth. And I said, Mr. Will, why do you think anti-Semitism exists? Well, he was nonplussed. He didn't know what to say. Because George Will is smart enough to know what the politically correct answer is for all these kinds of questions. And his answer was, I don't really know. I think it has something to do with Christianity, he said. Well, of course, that's either a stupid answer or a deceitful answer. It's either stupid because he doesn't know much about history, because this phenomenon, this tension between a very self-aware, powerful group and a focused group and other peoples has existed in cultures that have nothing to do with Christianity. This is in the ancient world. Of course, if you leave the book of Old Testament, in ancient Egypt, and it persisted in every country over the centuries where Jews have lived in significant numbers, something called the Jewish question, anti-Semitism, that's a modern term, the Jewish question, this tension has existed. In the ancient world, Alexandria, it led to riots. There's a very good book called The Jewish Strategy here by Revel Oliver on that subject. In the ancient Roman Empire, among the Greeks, and of course, now the Arab world is considered anti-Semitic. But the big thing that's changed over the years is this. Whereas in the past, the Jewish question was an issue or a tension or a problem that existed in a particular region or a particular country or a city and was usually followed by expulsion from that place. And then later, I think in the 1930s and 40s, became a continental-wide question. Today, it is a global question. It's a global issue because the power of the organized Jewish community, the Jewish lobby, the Israel lobby, whatever you call it, is one that has a particular grip here on the United States, the most powerful country in the world, certainly one with the biggest military, and is fortified by having a base of support in a country of their own, Israel, that is supplemental in addition to the power that already exists here in the United States, and one feeds off the other. But this question exists now as a worldwide question. Now, going back to George Will, he would say, he gave an evasive answer. And I understand why he gave an evasive answer, because the Anti-Defamation League, the Simon Wiesenthal Center, Elie Wiesel, when confronted this question, why does anti-Semitism exist, their answer is, it's inexplicable. It's a disease. It's a phenomenon. We don't understand where it comes from. And they insist that there is no relationship between what Jews do and what people think of Jews. Now, that defies common sense. So much so that some years ago, George Soros, the very wealthy Jewish financier, gave a talk to a meeting of the Anti-Defamation League. Now, he doesn't usually do this. George Soros usually stays away from overtly Jewish organizations. But he did, in this case, he gave a talk to the Anti-Defamation League. And in the course of his talk, he made the remark, rather mild remark, that he's afraid that Israeli policy may have the effect of exacerbating anti-Jewish feeling in the world, and especially in Europe. Well, immediately the next day, the Anti-Defamation League denounced this statement by their own speaker because they don't want to admit there's any relationship at all between what Jews do or what Israel does and this terrible phenomenon of anti-Semitism. They don't want to acknowledge that. Well, in fact, there is a relationship, and it's not. This is part and parcel of a society, the one we live in, that's in denial about some of the most basic realities, not merely about race, but certainly about power in our society. Now, there is no group in America, no single ethnic religious group that has more power than the organized Jewish community. There is no significant policy carried out by our government that's contrary to the interests and the will of the organized Jewish community. That's not true of any other group, whether it's fundamental Christians, Catholics, who make up something like 40% of the population. We live in a country where abortion is not only legal, it has to be legal. It can't be made illegal, contrary to the religious views of Catholics. It used to be the religious views of most Christians, for example. And on all sorts of issues, time and time again, Jewish sensibilities and Jewish interests are paramount, absolutely paramount. Nowhere more so, of course, in our foreign policy, where our political leaders, whether Democratic or Republican, insist and swear by their defense of Israel under any circumstance, absolutely pledged to their security, guaranteeing their security, and also, in addition, emphatically guaranteeing their support for Israel, not really as a state or a nation, but as a specifically Jewish state, something the United States doesn't do for any other country. Now, for white nationalists, or for this audience, one of the most biggest things we face is this barrage of multicultural, diversity is wonderful propaganda that is pushed constantly in our media. Many people may not know this, but the slogan, "Diversity is our strength," is a slogan that the Anti-Defamation League, perhaps the most powerful Jewish Zionist organization in America, claims credit for inventing. About a year after the Anti-Defamation began a campaign promoting this slogan, President Clinton, at the time, used this slogan in a major address, and he modified it. He said, not that diversity is our strength, but diversity is our greatest strength, he said. And the Anti-Defamation League, in their bulletin, took a note of this with pride that Clinton had not only used their slogan, but had made it even stronger, even better. Now, this slogan, diversity is our strength, is one that our political leaders, our educational leaders, our cultural system embraces, in fact, as a dogma. And anybody who criticizes it is denounced as a hater, as a supremacist, all sorts of things. This is supposedly a terrible thing. But it's a slogan that is so obviously untrue to anybody who's had much experience in life, who knows much about history. And the proof that I've made this point over and over that this is a lie is that the very people who promote this slogan show by their actions they don't believe it themselves. The Anti-Defamation League insists that diversity is our strength, but they lie when they say our strength. They mean it's something for the Gentiles, something for the Goyim. For Jews, exactly the opposite principle is the one in place. For Jews and organizations like the Anti-Defamation League, they insist that Israel must be a specifically Jewish ethnic religious state. And that underscores the essential double standard, the essential hypocrisy, not only in this regard, which is dangerous for the white race and indeed for all races, but underscores the double standard that prevails in American society, in our political life, our cultural life, our social life, across the board, because an adherence or a support of the interests and the agenda of the Jewish Zionist group, of that Jewish Zionist power, means a betrayal of the interests of every other group in every other way. I put it this way. If you are a sincere liberal, or if you are a sincere conservative, you must reject this Jewish Zionist power. If you're a sincere liberal, and you're consistent about the importance of egalitarian societies or justice, then you have support for a state which has institutionalized discrimination against its non-Jewish population, which has violated numerous Security Council resolutions, which is the only state in the Middle East that occupies territory of its neighbors, is one that every liberal should understand and reject for that reason. And anyone who is a sincere conservative should equally be appalled by an organization or an organized community that promotes slogans and promotes an agenda and promotes policies that mean the destruction of everything worth conserving, everything worth holding on to. Now, a very good point was made earlier, I thought, in the evening, and in the morning, by Kevin McDonald, and he said, a lot of what we're doing is not new. We're not having talks here this afternoon that are going to shed new amazing light, although I never knew about the pintails and the mallards before. But it's not so important to do that. It's to talk about what this means for us in as much as possible a practical way. And with regard to the Jewish question, the points, these kinds of points, it's not necessary to make new discoveries about this. As one speaker pointed out, much of this has been laid out very, very well over the years, over the decades, by many others, much more articulate than anybody here this morning. But it's necessary to make these points over and over again, highlighting this hypocrisy. If there's anything that needs to be stressed, it's this essential point that in our society, no group has as much power, has the decisive power, as the organized Jewish community. We live in a society that is in the grip of this Jewish Zionist power. Now, I know a lot of Americans find that very disturbing. If you even talk about Jews as a separate group, that's considered very, very dangerous. Because the ideology of America is that people come here and they all join in and we become all Americans. But obviously, the obvious untruth of that statement is that the Jewish community itself regards itself as a separate group with separate interests. And the proof of that is that almost all Jews in the United States or around the world, but almost all Jews in America regard themselves as Zionists, as followers of Zionism. The essence of Zionism is Jewish nationalism. It's based on the premise that Jews are a separate and distinct nation, a distinct people, and therefore that Jews should and must have a primary loyalty to this nation state, this group, this people. And that it's and to say then, therefore, that there's no Jewish question is to ignore a reality that Jewish leaders themselves say. A few years ago, I was interviewed by a Jewish writer who did another big hit piece on me. And it's very unfortunate that it goes with the territory. You do interviews, and sometimes they're good, and sometimes they're hit pieces. But anyway, this Jewish writer did this long story with me. I made a lot of these points with him, made the same points. I said the same thing to him that I say to everybody else. And I asked him, I said, several times during the course of this lengthy interview, actually went over several days, I said, have I said anything in the course of this conversation that you think is factually wrong or hateful or bad? And he thought about it, and he said, what disturbs me is that the remarks you make, if made by a Jew, made in a synagogue or in a conversation, nobody would find exceptional. Nobody would find unusual. But it's very unusual and unsettling or disturbing, for what you're to use, when a Gentile says it. Now, that's the whole point. We have a tremendous opportunity to make tremendous impact by merely stating the truth, merely stating the reality. And these points that we're making in this conference here this weekend, and the points that we try to make over and over again, are truthful, they're real, they're based on reality, and they need to be said over and over again. I want to affirm this basic point that Kevin MacDonald, we need to repeat this and bring it out as it applies to new things happening all the time. The other day there was a little news item that we put on our website. I urge everybody, in fact, if they don't know about it, to check out our website, ihr.org, Institute for Historical Review, and look at a lot of these things. But I put an item there about a fact that a Jewish art dealer in California is going to be putting up for auction some portraits of Hitler. And he thinks he'll sell them for some tremendous amount of money. Now, as far as I know, no one in the United States... made the point that I made about this in a broadcast I did. And that is, these are stolen objects. These are stolen paintings. Now, it's unclear who stole them, but they were probably stolen at the end of the war by a French or American soldier who just took them. Now, any artwork that had belonged to a Jew in Europe in the 1930s and 40s, there's a huge hue and cry to make sure it's returned to its rightful owner. But objects that belong to Hitler or the Germans, or, quote, the Nazis, that's free game. It's steal, and nobody even brings it up. Now, that's an example of just one of so many of the double standards that exists in our society. And it's replicated, it's repeated over and over and over again. And anyone who cares about just intellectual consistency, if not justice, should be concerned about a government, our government, that repeatedly, continually carries out policies that represent one standard, basically, for Israel and Jews, and another standard for everyone else. So much so that we have political leaders now who are more supportive of Israel than they are of the United States.
Yeah.
Just a few weeks ago, in May, Benjamin Netanyahu spoke to the U.S. Congress. He was interrupted, depending on your count, by 30 standing ovations, repeatedly. He got more standing ovations, more applause than he gets from his own Israeli parliament, and more than any American president gets from the U.S. Congress. Now, why is that? Is it because American politicians are so insightful, are so more aware than people in other countries, or even Israelis, that they do this? No. They want to get elected. They want to get reelected. They want power. And they know that giving homage to Benjamin Netanyahu is securing their interests with the group that has real power in America, the organized Jewish community, this Jewish Zionist power. And that is a sign of a country that, in a very fundamental way, has become very corrupt, because they're putting their own individual career interests ahead of the interests of the country and against ahead of the interests of humanity. Now, you'll find very much that I try to put very much these issues in universal terms, and that's why the IHR website is first and foremost interested in this in a global and a historical sense, because I believe very strongly that we must reach out to people, no matter who their background is, to support the breaking of this power which is destructive to all of us, to all nations, to all cultures. In fact, if we have a world that the Anti-Defamation League is in favor of, a world in which diversity is our strength, it means ultimately end of higher art, a technological achievement. It means the destruction of everything that's worthwhile in a society. Well, that's all I have to say about that issue now, but I would be pleased to answer questions, and I'll turn over the microphone then to Kevin McDonald.
Thank you.
During the question and answer session, one attendee asked the following question: has there ever been a problem with Jews in Eastern Asia? And has there ever been any outspoken Eastern Asian government officials speaking out against Jews?
Yeah, but first about the first question, the reason that there was a, you might say, a handling of the Jewish question in Muslim countries and in Europe for much of history is because the dominant factor in society was religious. Jews were oppressed in Europe, were kept in a separate position because as long they were a separate religion. And religious sensibilities were absolutely paramount. They pervaded everything. So much so, I mean, earlier we're talking about the tendency of white people to do things that are self-destructive. The best example I can think of in history is the madness of the Children's Crusade. It had white people in Italy, Germany, and France turn over their children to, in a spectacular show of moral righteousness, we're going to march to the Holy Land and so impress the Muslims there that they would take over, the Christians would take over the Holy Land. Well, this is a tragic thing, and there must be hundreds, thousands of little tragedies, as a mother was saying, well, my little Pierre or my little Hans, I don't want him going off on this thing, and the parish priest saying, no, no, you have to do this for God, this is the right thing, he'll go to heaven. And these children, eventually, they were all sold into slavery and died. It was a very tragic thing, but people are willing to sacrifice even their children for an idea this strong. Muslims take their religion as seriously, or many of them do, as Christians used to take Christianity seriously. And Christians used to take their religion so seriously that Jews, who are a different religion, were segregated and kept in a separate status. But they got all the privileges as soon as they converted to Christianity. And the same thing's true in the Muslim world. If a Jew becomes a Muslim, then he's instantly accepted as equal. Now, in the modern world, since the Enlightenment, religion doesn't have that place. And Jews, of course, have taken tremendous advantage of the fact that we regard people as individuals. And so on that basis, Jews have this tremendous power. But that's the answer to that. Now, with regard to East Asia, there's been small Jewish community at one time in China. There's been no real significant Jewish community in Japan, although there are some now American Jews and so forth. So it's never been a real issue. Now, China, though, and Chinese traditionally have had such a very strong sense of their own ethnic identity, such a strong sense of who they are, that the idea of foreigners or outsiders of any kind having large influence was almost unthinkable. In fact, the very word China means the Middle Kingdom, the Central Kingdom, the center of the universe, essentially. And for centuries, the Chinese took the view that all other people are or should be subordinate to the Emperor of China. But anyway, it hasn't been an issue in Asia because there have been very, very few Jews. But it is an international issue. It's now a global issue. And all over the world, there is a consensus that what Israel is doing and what the United States is doing in support of Israel is wrong. This is reflected over and over in the United Nations, in which there are lopsided votes, in which Israel and the United States and maybe the Marshall Islands are on one side, and the whole rest of the world is on the other. One of the biggest setbacks or defeats for the organized Jewish power in the world has been the abandonment of Zionism and of Israel by the European left over the last 20 years. Now, Israel, and in Norway, we saw the example of that. The leading leftist party in Norway is supportive of the efforts to boycott Israel, divest, and so forth. And this is across the board now in almost all the world. The last great bastion of Jewish power politically, culturally, and so forth, is here in the United States. And Jews know this. They're very, very aware of this. I snuck in, as it were, to a huge AIPAC rally in Southern California, and this is a point they made. Congress is our linchpin. If we lose that, we're screwed, because they know that around the world there's very little sympathy left for Israel and what Jews are doing around the world. And there's an awareness of this, basically around the world. It's only in America where people as deluded or self-deluded as Michelle Bachmann or all these people can say, you know, how much they proclaim their love for Israel, a love that they don't proclaim for any other country except maybe in this weird way for the United States. But anyway, the state of the world Jewish question is, it is a world question. And this is the center of that power right here. I think it's really crucial that we highlight and emphasize that here in the bastion of that power, because the most deluded, the most misguided, the most misled people in the world are the American people.
Later on, the following question was asked. On the question of the Jews in China, how did communism get to China, and what about the Opium Wars and the manufacturing being moved out of the United States to China? Don't the Jews have something to do with American manufacturing, so they must be there now?
Well, there are Jews in China. I was in China 2 years ago. I'm pretty confident Chinese are not going to be fooled by anybody. They're not going to buy. They don't buy for a moment this egalitarian nonsense in the United States. They've seen what egalitarianism in a real form can mean during the Great Cultural Revolution or the Great Leap Forward, which was madness and destructive. But having said that, with regard to how did communism, it's interesting that the only countries in the world where the Communist Party is still in power, Vietnam, China, North Korea, and Cuba, the only countries who are still in power is where they came to power, where the communists came to power, not as communists, but as nationalists. Nationalism is a far, far more powerful force than communism or any other of these kinds of ideologies. And communism is still in power in China, and the Communist Party is in power, even though it's entirely abandoned Marxism in any serious sense of the word. It prides itself on being the party that made China independent and strong and prosperous. And the same thing is true of the Communist Party of Vietnam, where it came to power as a nationalist movement. In every other country, communism is gone because it was imposed in Eastern Europe by a Red Army and in the Soviet Union basically by a coup organized by Jews. But now, around the world, the Jewish question is a very important one. Now, most people don't put it that way. They'll talk about the power of Zionism or the Israel lobby. But nonetheless, that's what it amounts to. That's what it is. And it's very important, above all, that the fight be carried out against this power here in the center of that power of the United States.